by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Grass make dab in the middle. We are grass make dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We're going to begin the program with a speech by Pompeo, Secretary of State Pompeo, given it at the Nixon Library. And it's a very powerful speech. And just recently, we have expelled the Chinese from the consulate in Houston. They are gone. They padlocked one of the doors, and so they can't get back in. So anyway, they are gone. Then we'll take back over the property at that time. But anyway, this is what Secretary of State Pompeo says about this crisis with China. Here we go now.
My remarks today are the fourth set of remarks in a series of China speeches that I asked National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien, FBI Director Chris Wray, and the Attorney General Barr to deliver alongside me. We had a very clear purpose, a real mission, was to explain the different facets of America's relationship with China, the massive imbalances in that relationship that have built up over decades, and the Chinese Communist Party's designs for hegemony. Our goal was to make clear that the threats to Americans that President Trump's China policy aims to address are clear, and our strategy for securing those freedoms established. You know, Ambassador Bryan spoke about ideology. FBI Director Wray talked about espionage. Attorney General Barr spoke about economics. And now my goal today is to put it all together for the American people in detail what the China threat means for our economy, for our liberty, and indeed for the future of free democracies around the world. Next year marks half a century since Dr. Kissinger's secret mission to China, and the 50th anniversary of President Nixon's trip isn't too far away in 2022. You know, the world was much different then. We imagined engagement with China would produce a future with bright promise of comity and cooperation. But today we're all still wearing masks and watching the pandemic's body count rise because the CCP failed in its promises to the world. We're reading every morning new headlines of repression in Hong Kong and in Xinjiang. We're seeing staggering statistics of Chinese trade abuses that cost American jobs and strike enormous blows to the economies all across America, including here in Southern California. And we're watching a Chinese military that grows stronger and stronger, and indeed more menacing. I'll echo the questions ringing in the hearts and minds of Americans from here in California to my home state of Kansas and beyond. What do the American people have to show now, 50 years on, from engagement with China? Did the theories of our leaders that proposed a Chinese evolution towards freedom and democracy prove to be true? Is this China's definition of a win-win situation? And indeed, centrally, from the Secretary of State's perspective, is America safer? Do we have a greater likelihood of peace for ourselves and peace for the generations which will follow us? Look, we have to admit a hard truth. We must admit a hard truth that should guide us in the years and decades to come, that if we want to have a free 21st century and not the Chinese century of which Xi Jinping dreams, the old paradigm of blind engagement with China simply won't get it done. We must not continue it. And we must not return to it. As President Trump has made very clear, we need a strategy that protects the American economy and indeed our way of life. The free world must triumph over this new tyranny. Now, before I seem too eager to tear down President Nixon's legacy, I want to be clear that he did what he was believed was best for the American people at the time, and he may well have been right. He was a brilliant student of China, a fierce cold warrior, and a tremendous admirer of the Chinese people, just as I think we all are. He deserves enormous credit for realizing that China was too important to be ignored, even when the nation was weakened because of its own self-inflicted communist brutality. In 1967, in a very famous Foreign Affairs article, Nixon explained his future strategy. Here's what he said. He said, "Taking the long view, we simply cannot afford to leave China forever outside of the family of nations. The world cannot be safe until China changes. Thus, our aim, to the extent we can, we must influence events. Our goal should be to induce change." And I think that's the key phrase from the entire article, to induce change. So with that historic trip to Beijing, President Nixon kicked off our engagement strategy. He nobly sought a freer and safer world, and he hoped that the Chinese Communist Party would return that commitment. As time went on, American policymakers increasingly presumed that as China became more prosperous, it would open up, it would become freer at home, and indeed present less of a threat abroad. It'd be friendlier. It all seemed, I am sure, so inevitable. But that age of inevitability is over. The kind of engagement we've been pursuing has not brought the kind of change inside of China that President Nixon had hoped to induce. The truth is that our policies and those of other free nations resurrected China's failing economy only to see Beijing bite the international hands that were feeding it. We opened our arms to Chinese citizens only to see the Chinese Communist Party exploit our free and open society. China sent propagandists into our press conferences, our research centers, our high schools, our colleges, and even into our PTA meetings. We marginalized our friends in Taiwan, which later blossomed into a vigorous democracy. We gave the Chinese Communist Party and the regime itself special economic treatment, only to see the CCP insist on silence over its human rights abuses as the price of admission for Western companies entering China. Ambassador Bryant ticked off a few examples just the other day. Marriott, American Airlines, Delta, United all removed references to Taiwan from their corporate websites so as not to anger Beijing. And Hollywood, not too far from here, the epic center of American creative freedom and self-appointed arbiters of social justice, self-censors even the most mildly unfavorable reference to China. This corporate acquiescence to the CCP happens all over the world, too. And how has this corporate fealty worked? Is its flattery rewarded? I'll give you a quote from the speech that General Barr gave, Attorney General Barr. In his speech last week, he said that the ultimate ambition of China's rulers isn't to trade with the United States, it is to raid the United States. China ripped off our prized intellectual property and trade secrets, causing millions of jobs all across America. It sucked supply chains away from America and then added a widget made of slave labor. It made the world's key waterways less safe for international commerce. President Nixon once said he feared he had created a Frankenstein by opening the world to the CCP. And here we are. Now, people of good faith can debate why free nations allowed these bad things to happen for all these years. Perhaps we were naive about China's virulent strain of communism, or triumphalist after our victory in the Cold War, or cravenly capitalist, or hoodwinked by Beijing's talk of a peaceful rise. Whatever the reason, today China is increasingly authoritarian at home and more aggressive in its hostility to freedom everywhere else. And President Trump has said enough. I don't think many people on either side of the aisle dispute the facts that I've laid out today. But even now, some are insisting that we preserve the model of dialogue for dialogue's sake. Now, to be clear, we'll keep on talking, but the conversations are different these days. I traveled to Honolulu now just a few weeks back to meet with Yang Jiechi. It was the same old story, plenty of words, but literally no offer to change any of the behaviors. Yang's promises, like so many the CCP made before him, were empty. His expectations, I summarize, were that I'd cave to their demands, because frankly, this is what too many prior administrations have done. I didn't, and President Trump will not either. As Ambassador O'Brien explained so well, we have to keep in mind that the CCP regime is a Marxist-Leninist regime. General Secretary Xi Jinping is a true believer in a bankrupt totalitarian ideology. It's this ideology that informs his decades-long desire for global hegemony of Chinese communism. America can no longer ignore the fundamental political and ideological differences between our countries, just as the CCP has never ignored them. My experience in the House Intelligence Committee, and then as director of the Central Intelligence Agency, and my now 2+ years as America's Secretary of State have led me to this central understanding that the only way to truly change communist China is to act not on the basis of what Chinese leaders say, but how they behave. And you can see American policy responding to this conclusion. President Reagan said that he dealt with the Soviet Union on the basis of trust but verify. When it comes to the CCP, I say we must distrust and verify. We, the freedom-loving nations of the world must induce China to change, just as President Nixon wanted. We must induce China to change in more creative and assertive ways because Beijing's actions threaten our people and our prosperity. We must start by changing how our people and our partners perceive the Chinese Communist Party. We have to tell the truth. We can't treat this incarnation of China as a normal country just like any other. We know that trading with China is not like trading with a normal law-abiding nation. Beijing threatens international agreements as treats international suggestions as or agreements as suggestions, as conduits for global dominance. But by insisting on fair terms, as our trade representative did when he secured our Phase One trade deal, we can force China to reckon with its intellectual property theft and policies that have harmed American workers. We know, too, that doing business with a CCP-backed company is not the same as doing business with, say, a Canadian company. They don't answer to independent boards, and many of them are state-sponsored and so have no need to pursue profits. A good example is Huawei. We stopped pretending Huawei is an innocent telecommunications company just showing up to make sure you can talk to your friends. We've called it what it is, a true national security threat, and we've taken action accordingly. We know, too, that if our companies invest in China, they may wittingly or unwittingly support the Communist Party's gross human rights violations. Our Departments of Treasury and Commerce have thus sanctioned blacklisted Chinese leaders and entities that are harming and abusing the most basic rights for people all across the world. Several agencies have worked together on a business advisor to make certain that our CEOs are informed of how their supply chains are behaving inside of China. We know, too, that not all Chinese students and employees are just normal students and workers that are coming here to make a little bit of money and to garner themselves some knowledge. Too many of them come here to steal our intellectual property and to take this back to their country. The Department of Justice and other agencies have vigorously pursued punishment for these crimes. We know that the People's Liberation Army is not a normal army, too. Its purpose is to uphold the absolute rule of the Chinese Communist Party elites and expand a Chinese empire, not to protect the Chinese people. And so our Department of Defense has ramped up its efforts, freedom of navigation operations out throughout the East and South China Seas and in the Taiwan Strait as well. And we've created a space force to help deter China from aggression on that final frontier. And so, too, frankly, we built out a new set of policies at the State Department dealing with China, pushing President Trump's goals for fairness and reciprocity to rewrite the imbalances that have grown over decades. Just this week, we announced the closure of the Chinese consulate in Houston because it was a hub of spying and intellectual property theft. We reversed 2 weeks ago 8 years of cheek-turning with respect to international law in the South China Sea. We've called on China to conform its nuclear capabilities to the strategic realities of our time. And the State Department at every level, all across the world, has engaged with our Chinese counterparts simply to demand fairness and reciprocity. But our approach can't just be about getting tough. That's unlikely to achieve the outcome that we desire. We must also engage and empower the Chinese people, a dynamic, freedom-loving people who are completely distinct from the Chinese Communist Party. That begins with in-person diplomacy. I've met Chinese men and women of great talent and diligence wherever I go. I've met with Uyghurs and ethnic Kazakhs who have escaped Xinjiang's concentration camps. I've talked with Hong Kong's democracy leaders, from Cardinal Zen to Jimmy Lai. 2 days ago, in London, I met with Hong Kong freedom fighter Nathan Law. And last month, in my office, I heard the stories of Tiananmen Square survivors. One of them's here today. Wang Dan was a key student who has never stopped fighting for freedom for the Chinese people. Mr. Wang, will you please stand so that we may recognize you? Also with us today is the father of the Chinese democracy movement, Wei Xinsheng. He spent decades in Chinese labor camps for his advocacy. Mr. Wei, will you please stand? You know, I grew up and served my time in the army during the Cold War. If there's one thing I learned, communists almost always lie. The biggest lie that they tell is to think that they speak for 1.4 billion people who are surveilled, oppressed, and scared to speak out. Quite the contrary, the CCP fears the Chinese people's honest opinions more than any foe. And save for losing their own grip on power, they have no reason to. Just think how much better off the world would be, not to mention the people inside of China, if we had been able to hear from the doctors in Wuhan and they'd been allowed to raise the alarm about the outbreak of a new and novel virus. For too many decades, our leaders have ignored, downplayed the words of brave Chinese citizens and warned us about the nature of the regime we're facing, and we can't ignore it any longer. They know as well as anyone that we can never go back to the status quo. But changing the CCP's behavior cannot be the mission of the Chinese people, and free nations have to work to defend freedom. It's the furthest thing from easy. But I have faith we can do it. I have faith because we've done it before. We know how this goes. I have faith because the CCP is repeating some of the same mistakes that the Soviet Union made. Alienating potential allies, breaking trust at home and abroad, rejecting property rights and predictable rule of law. I have faith. I have faith because of the awakening I see among other nations that know we can't go back to the past in the same way that we do here in America. I've heard this from Brussels to Sydney to Hanoi. And most of all, I have faith we can defend freedom because of the sweet appeal of freedom itself. Look at the Hong Kongers clamoring to emigrate abroad as the CCP tightens its grip on that proud city. They wave American flags. It's true. There are differences. Unlike the Soviet Union, China is deeply integrated into the global economy. But Beijing is more dependent on us than we are on them. Look, I reject the notion that we're living in an age of inevitability, that some trap is preordained, that CCP supremacy is the future. Our approach isn't destined to fail because America is in decline. As I said in Munich earlier this year, the free world is still winning. We just need to believe it and know it and be proud of it. People from all over the world still want to come to open societies. They come here to study. They come here to work. They come here to build a life for their families. They're not desperate to settle in China. It's time. It's great to be here today. The timing is perfect. It's time for free nations to act. Not every nation will approach China in the same way, nor should they. Every nation will have to come to its own understanding of how to protect its own sovereignty, how to protect its own economic prosperity, and how to protect its ideals from the tentacles of the Chinese Communist Party. But I call on every leader of every nation to start by doing what America has done, to simply insist on reciprocity, to insist on transparency and accountability from the Chinese Communist Party. It's a cadre of rulers that are far from homogenous And these simple and powerful standards will achieve a great deal. For too long, we let the CCP set the terms of engagement. But no longer. Free nations must set the tone. We must operate on the same principles. We have to draw common lines in the sand that cannot be washed away by the CCP's bargains or their blandishments. Indeed, this is what the United States did recently when we rejected China's unlawful claims in the South China Sea once and for all, as we have urged countries to become clean countries so that their citizens' private information doesn't end up in the hand of the Chinese Communist Party. We did it by setting standards. Now, it's true, it's difficult. It's difficult for some small countries. They fear being picked off. Some of them, for that reason, simply don't have the ability or the courage to stand with us for the moment. Indeed, we have a NATO ally of ours that hasn't stood up in the way that it needs to with respect to Hong Kong because they fear Beijing will restrict access to China's market. This is the kind of timidity that will lead to historic failure. And we can't repeat it. We cannot repeat the mistakes of these past years. The challenge of China demands exertion, energy from democracies, those in Europe, those in Africa, those in South America, and especially those in the Indo-Pacific region. And if we don't act now, ultimately, the CCP will erode our freedoms and subvert the rules-based order that our societies have worked so hard to build. If we bend the knee now, our children's children may be at the mercy of the Chinese Communist Party, whose actions are the primary challenge today in the free world. General Secretary Xi is not destined to tyrannize inside and outside of China forever unless we allow it. Now, this isn't about containment. Don't buy that. It's about a complex new challenge that we've never faced before. The USSR was closed off from the free world. Communist China is already within our borders. So we can't face this challenge alone. The United Nations, NATO, the G7 countries, the G20, our combined economic, diplomatic, and military power is surely enough to meet this challenge if we direct it clearly and with great courage. Maybe it's time for a new grouping of like-minded nations, a new alliance of democracies. We have the tools. I know we can do it. Now we need the will. To quote Scripture, I ask, is our spirit willing, but our flesh weak? If the free world doesn't change, Communist China will surely change us. There can't be a return to the past practices because they're comfortable or because they're convenient. Securing our freedoms from the Chinese Communist Party is the mission of our time, and America is perfectly positioned to lead it because our founding principles give us that opportunity. As I explained in Philadelphia last week, staring at Independence Hall, our nation was founded on the premise that all human beings possess certain rights that are unalienable, and it's our government's job to secure those rights. It is a simple and powerful truth. It's meant as a beacon of freedom for people all around the world, including people inside of China. Indeed, Richard Nixon was right when he wrote in 1967 that the world cannot be safe until China changes. Now it's up to us to heed his words. Today, the danger is clear, and today the awakening is happening. Today, the free world must respond. We can never go back to the past. May God bless each of you. May God bless the Chinese people. And may God bless the people of the United States of America. Thank you all.
This is a serious break with China, and I applaud this administration wholeheartedly. China's ruthless. They're out to conquer the world and to steal everything they can from United States manufacturers and companies. And I believe what they were doing down in Houston, more than anything, I would think that they were trying to steal our oil technology secrets, because Houston is a center for the most advanced technology in oil exploration. And my ideas, being from Texas and Austin and knowing somewhat the oil industry in Texas, is I think their main target in Houston was the oil industry and its technology. They are mining throughout the world in Africa and other places. And so China is not just, they're not mining oil within the mainland of China, but they are exploring for oil and producing oil in other places. So that's sort of my idea there. Next coming up is Tucker Carlson interview with Robert Woodson. Robert Woodson is a fine stand-up black American that he says, okay, black businessmen and community leaders, let's pull ourselves up with our bootstraps. But here we go with that interview now with Robert Woodson, just a fine person.
Good evening and welcome to Tucker Carlson Tonight. Chicago is the third biggest city in the United States. Millions of people live there. For 150 years, it was the hub of America's manufacturing economy. If any one place can credibly claim to have built this country, it's Chicago. So we should care what happens there. Unfortunately, what is happening now in Chicago is almost all bad. In fact, it's a disaster. Thanks to the corruption of local officials, Chicago is bankrupt. The city is so deeply in debt, billions and billions, tens of billions of dollars in debt, that no economist believes it can ever pay its bills. Taxpayers know this. They understand they will be punished for the crimes of their leaders, so they're fleeing the city in record numbers. Those who've stayed behind now worry about getting killed. Just this week, so far, 106 people have been shot in Chicago. Just an hour after last night's show, for example, six people were shot in one drive-by shooting on the city's south side. Two of them died. And it's not just happening in poor neighborhoods in Chicago. Here's surveillance video of gunmen opening fire downtown. Two people were hit by bullets. One was killed. Among many others murdered in Chicago have been many, many children. This man's first grader, for example, was shot in the head.
To see my daughter on the table with a gunshot wound to the forehead.
7-year-old Natalia Wallace was shot in the head and killed over the weekend in Chicago as she played outside with her siblings.
Visualize the 7-year-old shot, bleeding to death while the family is there.
Also among the innocent victims, police say 14-year-old Vernando Jones was shot and killed by gang members on the 4th of July.
It's awful. Chicago wasn't always like this, and if you're from there, you know that very well. Chicago is a beautiful place. There are a lot of reasons it isn't anymore, but near the top of that list is a woman called Lori Lightfoot. She's the mayor. Like a lot of big city mayors, Lightfoot is incompetent. She has no idea what she's doing. You wouldn't let her plan your spring break. She'd send you to Wuhan by accident. But what makes Lori Lightfoot unusual is the remarkably aggressive way that she lies. Lightfoot says things that are so implausible they could be part of a comedy routine, but she's not joking. She expects you to believe every word of it. Here she is, for example, blaming violence in Chicago on, of all people, Republicans.
Why are we engaged in such violence? Because there are too many damn guns on our streets. And why is that so? Because the Republican leadership for way too long, including this president, refuses to even have a conversation about common sense gun reform.
See, it's the Republicans' fault that Chicago is now more dangerous than many third world countries. That makes sense. The only problem is there aren't really any Republicans in Chicago. Donald Trump got 12% of the vote there. Of the 50 aldermen on Chicago's city council right now, not a single one of them is a Republican, not one. So if you blame Republicans for what's happening in, say, West Texas or at the Villages, you might have a point. But in Chicago, it's absurd. Even Lori Lightfoot seems to know that that excuse just won't work. It's too stupid. So she's moved on to a new excuse. You know why Chicago is circling the drain right now? You know why all those children are getting murdered? Because of Christopher Columbus, yes, an Italian navigator who never got within 1,000 miles of the loop and who, by the way, died more than 500 years ago. He did it. It's Columbus's fault. This morning, Lightfoot ordered the city to take down 2 Christopher Columbus statues, one in Little Italy and one in Grant Park. That'll fix the problem. You can let your kids play outside now. Confusing on one level, though, in case you're wondering why Lightfoot chose Christopher Columbus to blame for a city's decline, why not Marco Polo? Why not Vasco da Gama? Well, there's a reason. Her constituents demanded it. Not voters or taxpayers. There was never any groundswell of opposition to Christopher Columbus in Chicago. He's not on the list of present concerns for most people there. No. Lightfoot's actual constituents wanted Columbus taken down. Her actual constituents are Antifa. Last week, the mob descended on Grant Park to rip down the Columbus statue. Almost 50 police officers were injured in the riot you just saw, but Lori Lightfoot didn't care. They're not her voters. Lightfoot cares about her base, the looters, the destroyers, the angry Marxist rich kids with the spray paint. When they tell her to act, Lori Lightfoot acts immediately. The problem for the rest of us is the mobs will not stop with Christopher Columbus. He's just the beginning. If they can tear down statues whenever they feel like it, how long before they tear down buildings? How long before they tear down homes? How long before they tear down human beings? Probably not very long. Violence rarely remains symbolic. It accelerates until good people rise up to stop it. If Lori Lightfoot and progressive mayors like her around the country, and there are many, are allowed to divert attention from their own failures by bowing to the mob and destroying public property, this will not end with Christopher Columbus. It will get much worse. And it will get more dangerous. You may not think tearing down a statue is a big deal until you are the next designated Christopher Columbus. Bob Woodson has studied American cities for decades. He founded the Woodson Center. We're honored to have him on tonight. Mr. Woodson, thanks so much for coming on.
I see
a theme here, and it's not just Lori Lightfoot. It's many big city mayors and even smaller city mayors. As the problems they face become more complex and harder to solve, their solutions seem to become more frivolous and more disconnected from reality. Have you noticed this?
Absolutely. And what they're doing is falsely claiming that the failures of the last 60 years, and most urban centers all over the country have been run by liberal Democrats, many of them veterans of the civil rights movement, who moved from politics, from the civil rights to run these cities. They also had to spend about $22 trillion on poverty money in these cities. And as a consequence, all of these inequities that they are talking about have been done on their watch. And so as conditions, spending went up as conditions deteriorated. But rather than address the reality of what they do is they point to institutional racism or factors that exempts them from any responsibility for taking care of these problems. And now the white left is coming in and exploiting this disparity and using it to really decimate this country. And the collateral damage are the lives of poor blacks in these cities, because what the left is doing is vilifying the police as agents of white supremacy. And the more they are vilified, the less aggressive they are about enforcing laws, the more the murder rate rises. What black, low-income blacks are facing is not bigotry or institutional racism. It is systematic neglect and abandonment and treasonous behavior. Bigotry is not their biggest challenge. It's treason. What is happening in these cities is the difference, Tucker, between a burglar who steals what's in your house and an embezzler that steals everything you've accumulated over a lifetime. And what black America is being stolen is their history of how they resisted and overcame oppression, and that's being wiped away. Chicago used to be the black Wall Street in segregation. In 1929, there were 731 black-owned businesses. There were 100 million in real estate assets at a time when segregation was the law. And so you can't blame institutional racism or systematic racism or legacy of slavery for the failures. This has occurred precisely as the civil rights leaders became leaders of these cities.
So Lori Lightfoot would tell you, and again, it's not just Lori Lightfoot by a mile, it's virtually every one of these mayors, that she cares so deeply about the poorest people in her city. Should we believe that?
Absolutely not. I mean, and I believe, Tucker, that the salvation of this country, may sound odd, are going to be that sleeping giant when low-income blacks wake up and realize that they're being bamboozled and hustled and scammed by people like Lori Lightfoot and others. They are going to realize that they must address the enemy within, because the left derives its moral authority as being the legitimate representatives of the poor. A metaphor for that occurred in Oregon when a black police officer was talking to two young black demonstrators, and a white demonstrator interposed herself in between and said, F the police. And this, so that's a metaphor for how whites are exploiting that. But one day, there's evidence that that sleeping giant, that low-income leaders around the country are recognizing this, as in Washington, an 11-year-old boy was killed, Tucker, on 4th of July. And the people demonstrated internally and said, no justice, no sleep. And they picketed and made noise until the killers were turned in. Another group of the Alliance of Concerned Men in Washington, D.C., a group of healing agents within the highest crime area, has gone now 65 days without a single violent incident, because they addressed their problems by mobilizing the internal resources, the resilience, the self-determination of people inside. And so we've demonstrated that islands of peace can be created if you stop looking externally and stop listening to the left, and instead listen to the people and give them the power to be agents of their own uplift, and stop these hustlers from exploiting them, like Lori Lightfoot.
And it is about the power of the Democratic Party. That's all it's about. It's all it's ever about, of course. Mr. Woodson, thank you. Great to see you tonight. Thank you.
Thank you.
Here's where Press Secretary McEnany says about Chicago and so forth, and also about some of these outspoken accusations of stormtroopers and so forth. But here we go with Press Secretary McEnany. Okay, here we go now.
Hello, everyone. The first duty of government is to protect the safety of our citizens. That's what Attorney General Barr said when he was here at the White House just a few days ago. For 55 days in Portland, Oregon, we've seen lawlessness, anarchy, and destruction that threatens peace in our streets and the safety of our fellow American citizens and the safety of our brave law enforcement officers. Yet some Democrats and some in the media continue to ignore reality. As Portland's Democrat Mayor Ted Wheeler tweeted, quote, "What I saw last night was powerful in many ways. I listened, heard, and stood with the protesters, and I saw what it means when the federal government unleashes paramilitary forces against its own people." That was a quote from the Democrat mayor, who quite literally stood in the middle of a riot as violent protesters attacked a federal building. That is appalling, and Mayor Wheeler's clearly failing at his duty to protect his streets and his city there in Portland. The federal government has a sworn duty to uphold the laws of the United States. Through field offices and federal facilities across the country, these agents protect and serve the American people. Yet the rhetoric of the left undermines our justice system, with Nancy Pelosi calling them stormtroopers, Jim Clyburn calling them the Gestapo, and Wheeler using the term paramilitary forces. Under President Trump, violent crime rates in America finally began to fall. Rhetoric like this cannot be allowed to set us back. Augmenting the Federal Protective Service, guarding federal property in Portland, our brave officers have our brave officers have faced all of these various things, like rioters barricading officers inside the Hatfield Federal Courthouse, trapping officers inside. A, quote, commercial-grade mortar firework was launched by rioters. A federal agent's hand was impaled by planted nails. Another federal agent was shot with a pellet gun, leaving a wound deep to the bone, and tragically, three federal officers were likely left permanently blinded by the rioters using lasers pointed directly at their eyes. These are not the actions of so-called peaceful protesters, and the Trump administration will not stand by and allow anarchy in our streets. Law and order will prevail, and I have a short video for you because I want it to be real what is happening right now in Portland. So if we could play that video, that'd be great.
So that Portland is bad news. And just recently, it's been reported that the city, Portland, has sent a cease and desist order calling for removal of the courthouse fencing. Man, there's a fence that the feds built around the courthouse buildings and so forth to keep the, not demonstrators, but the rioters and the revolutionaries away from burning down the courthouse. And Portland authorities here, according to this article on Fox, are calling on the government to remove fencing around the federal courthouse and amid ongoing protests or face legal action, according to a recently published official letter. Okay, they're saying Portland's calling these barriers, illegally installed concrete and metal barriers, are both unpermitted and represent a hazard to the traveling public. The traveling public, are you kidding? The city's in rioting. What the hell are they talking about? The letter goes on and said a letter sent with a cease and desist order to a federal official Thursday. Among other things, they said that the fence and so these barriers block a bike lane, according to the document. Okay. And are you kidding me? There's rioting. There's revolutionaries out the side trying to burn down. The Portland, the city of Portland is talking about, you know, a wall or something, a fence and barriers just to keep the rioters from getting right up close to the buildings and burning them down. This is how really off the wall this has gotten. And that Ted Wheeler's off, he's come off the rails. He's off the rails on this. There's no other way to describe him. He went in there, I think it was Wednesday night, gets a whiff of, tear gas, and then they write up a deal about he and other protesters were gassed and all this real sympathetic stuff. But the other side of the story is the mob in there were making big demands of him and ran him out of there. Reportedly he had 5 bodyguards with him. So he didn't go in there unarmed unaccompanied, I should say. I don't know if he went in there armed or not, but I don't think he probably did. But he went in there with 5 bodyguards or someone to bodyguard him, you know, to protect him, because he wasn't quite sure of that crowd either, see. These mobs, they get out of control sometimes, and they just let loose everything. You can't trust them. A mob begins to take on its own mindset, its own riotous mindset. Anyway, more of that later in this hour. We'll conclude, make some concluding remarks at the end. Otherwise, I'm going to put up a quick little statement here by Greg Reese on 5G and exosomes. And it's only 2 or 3 minutes long, but it gives us a little bit of an example of what could be happening behind the scene of this 5G deployment. Here we go now with Greg Reese.
We know that the prescribed PCR tests are not detecting the COVID-19 genome. According to the CDC's own literature, the tests do not rule out bacterial infection or other viruses. They are detecting all varieties of coronavirus, including the common cold, and counting it as COVID-19. And it has been pointed out for months that the geographical locations experiencing the most cases of COVID also seem to have active 5G technology. After a video went viral in which David Icke suggested that 5G is somehow responsible for positive cases of COVID-19, YouTube deleted it and began deleting all videos on the subject, including a video we made that pointed out how on October 31st of 2019, Wuhan, China became the first major testbed of 5G technology. In late June, a new scientific research paper entitled 5G Technology and Induction of Coronavirus in Skin Cells was published. This paper gives a scientific explanation of the relationship between 5G technology and the coronavirus. Unlike 4G or other radio waves, the 5G millimeter waves can penetrate the nucleus of a cell. The DNA then acts as an inductor. It reacts to the 5G waves by producing an electromagnetic field. Like a shadow, the shape of the electromagnetic field reflects the hexagonal and pentagonal shapes of the DNA base pairs. This electromagnetic field produces holes in the cellular liquid. Hexagonal, pentagonal voids are created in the nucleoplasm. And to remedy this disturbance, extra bases are created to fill the voids. These bases then join together to produce coronavirus-like structures within the cell, which the PCR test will read as a positive case of COVID-19. The exosome. The exosome was discovered in 1983. Exosomes are created naturally within the cell to clean and repair cellular damage. Both exosomes and COVID-19 are the same size and shape. They both have the same ACE2 receptor, and they both contain RNA. Exosomes behave and appear the same as a virus. Some scientists even claim that the so-called virus is in fact the exosome. Since the discovery of the exosome, over 200 microbiologists have been murdered, committed suicide, or died in a suspicious manner. If you question this mystery, you're undoubtedly labeled a conspiracy theorist. And if you question the current unproven virus theory, you are labeled a science denier. The only socially acceptable solution that you are allowed to accept is an experimental vaccine that will alter your DNA, which ultimately raises the question, who owns your body? For InfoWars.com, this is Greg Reese.
Coming up next is KT McFarland, a former national security advisor, and she tells quite a story about, you know, this latest information that has come out that has been declassified implicates and reinforces the facts and the evidence that, yes, there was a conspiracy to spy on Trump during the campaign, during the transition, and even into his administration. So here we go with KT McFarland on an interview on Fox. Here we go now.
President Trump told Fox News' Sean Hannity that, yes, he is considering pardoning individuals implicated in the Trump-Russia probe. That could have potentially include General Michael Flynn if a lower court judge continues with that case and Michael Flynn loses. As we have more on this story we brought you last night, a newly declassified FBI memo written by an FBI agent in August 2016 reveals more in what we have been reporting for several years now, that the FBI did secretly plant an FBI agent at a routine briefing with Donald Trump and General Flynn to secretly spy on them for both the FBI's Trump-Russia probe and the FBI's new probe into General Michael Flynn that James Comey had just opened up a day before. Let's welcome back to the show. I know she's fired up. Former Trump Deputy National Security Advisor KT McFarland, author of the book Revolution. Great to see you, KT. When you heard that, what did you think? Was this the FBI's, quote, insurance policy that, you know, FBI official Peter Strzok had texted Lisa Page about to stop Trump from winning? Was that part of the insurance policy there?
I think it was part of it, but I think the insurance policy was much bigger. You know, here's the thing. Liz, not only were they spying, but they kept notes. I mean, how dumb are these FBI agents, right? They go to a briefing. They're there under a different purpose. I mean, a defensive briefing. A defensive briefing is for people who are new to classified information. And it tells you things like, look, you know, here's how people might try to recruit you to be spies. Don't give your dog walker the key to your apartment because who knows, the dog walker might be an agent of the Russian embassy. So there are all sorts of things that they show you and teach you how to protect yourself and how to protect classified information. So in the middle of these briefings, they've got their own spies. So here they are, supposedly telling the Trump administration people, here's how you got to watch out for Russian and Chinese spies. And the whole time they were spying themselves. And then they were taking notes and putting notes in the file. These guys are caught, I mean, red-handed.
You know, KT, you know, what's really interesting, too, let's break it down. Let's put in the context of what else was going on. In March 2016, Peter Strzok and Lisa Page text that Trump Trump has loathed them, that Hillary should win. August 8th, Lisa Page texts, quote, Trump's not ever going to be president, right? And Strzok texts back, no, he's not. Well, stop it. Then a week later, Strzok texts back Lisa Page about that insurance policy because they cannot take the risk that Trump wins. Then the next day, the FBI opens a probe into General Flynn. Then the day after that, the FBI uses its briefing to spy on Trump and Flynn. In the context of that, you could see what's going on, right, KT?
Sure. And at the same time, Liz, they were also leaking to their favorite newspaper reporters. You know, there were, at that same period of time, there were anonymous sources saying Donald Trump is an agent of the Russians. General Flynn was working with Vladimir Putin. Donald Trump never would have won the election if it hadn't been for Russian interference. So they were working it in a lot of different ways. They were spying on the Trump people, not only during the campaign, but frankly into the administration. They were leaking to anonymous sources. And then the intelligence community would point to those articles in the press saying, see, anonymous sources, we better really investigate further. So it was like a circular thing. They planted the stories, and then they used the stories to do the wiretapping and to do the sitting in on the meeting and the spying. And again, the thing I find extraordinary, Liz, they took notes. They either thought that they were so sure that Trump wouldn't win that they'd never be discovered, or they had this was their own personal insurance policy. So that if it was ever uncovered that they were doing the spying, they were doing the wrong deeds, they'd be able to blame the boss.
I want to ask you about that because FBI agent Joseph Pienka did the briefing with Trump and Flynn. He wrote the memo about it.
Yeah.
Peter Strzok signed off on it. So did Kevin Kleinsmith. Andrew McCabe, the FBI official, says they picked Pienka because he was a top agent on both the Trump, Russia, and Flynn probes. Pienka later interviews Flynn along with Peter Strzok, trying to corner Flynn into a perjury trap, lying to the FBI. Is it your sense that we're seeing documents released and declassified now because U.S. Attorney John Durham is talking to Pienka and maybe Peter Strzok in his criminal probe?
Yeah. I mean, here's how it works, at least in my experience. Because the Mueller I think that's exactly what's going on. These are documents being declassified and released to the public. They're only sent out to the public once the Justice Department and Durham are finished with them. I think they've already talked to Pienka. I think they're probably talking to Strzok, and then who knows, you know, how far up the food chain it goes. But that's how they do these investigations. They start small, and then you're supposed to plead guilty or blame your boss, and then the boss blames the boss, and it works its way up the food chain. I mean, that's how they came after me. In our case, of course, in the Trump administration, nobody had done anything wrong. And so it really was a lot of dead ends. In this case, it looks like they're uncovering an awful lot of stuff. I hope so.
All right, Keita McFarland, it's great to see you.
Next is Tom Fenton, Blue Dogs. Here we go now.
Joining us now is Tom Fenton. Tom is the president of Judicial Watch. His new book is A Republic Under Assault, The Left's Ongoing Attack on American Freedom, available for pre-order right now. Good to have you with us, Tom. Let's talk about Joe Pienka. He is the mystery man in all of this. He was the other FBI agent who accompanied Peter Strzok to the White House to entrap and to frame General Michael Flynn. How has the FBI gotten away with hiding this man and keeping him out of all view, at least I'm aware of, all public view?
Ask Director Wray. The FBI has been covering up key documents for years, and Wray's been part of the cover-up. The Justice Department's allowed it to go on as well. With these documents that came out this week, which document? These are FBI reports showing that Pienka, Strzok, and Kleinsmith, the guy who said that Viva the Resistance in his text messages and then altered allegedly the CIA information about Carter Page to make Page look like a good guy, when in fact he was a hero, in order to get a FISA warrant. They went in with the intelligence briefing, a counterintelligence briefing, to the Trump team. The president was there, then candidate Trump. General Flynn was there. And they were spying on him directly. They were taking notes about what Trump was saying and what Flynn were saying. Of course, they were saying innocent things. And they went in there under false pretenses, abused their trust. And then we get documents last week, Lou, that show that Strzok wanted to do the same thing at the Trump White House. Go in there under the false pretenses of FBI counterintelligence briefings to spy on Trump. Nothing like this has ever happened in American history. The president is being charitable to Barack Obama. Obama makes Richard Nixon look like a piker when it comes to targeting his political enemies.
And look at who has said that they're not going to reach to the Obama White House, will not be interested in talking with President Obama or Vice President Biden. The Attorney General has said that. The chair of the Judiciary Committee in the Senate has said that. I mean, that's outrageous that they would not reach as far as the facts take them. And the facts right now are pointing in that direction, I think, with bright red blinking lights.
There's that famous January 5th, 2017 meeting. It's an infamous meeting in the Oval Office where they talked about the dossier, the Logan Act, General Flynn being innocent, yet they all went to spy on and harass President Trump and obviously target General Flynn, Biden, Obama. They were all involved there. You put your finger on it. General Barr has said he doesn't even want to question these guys, Biden and Obama, about what they knew. That's why we filed a federal lawsuit this week to find out details about that corruption, because it's pretty clear DOJ is going to give Joe Biden a pass despite him being involved in the Obamagate scandal. In the least, they're witnesses, Lou. Let's say they're completely innocent of any wrongdoing. At least tell us what they knew and when so we can figure out who did the wrong thing.
Yeah, well, absolutely. This president has been under investigation by those very agencies, those very departments for almost four years. And we're not going to ask a question of the president who authorized such outright scandalous, treasonous behavior. I mean, it's insane to think that he didn't authorize it. They're having meetings in the Oval Office for crying out loud. It's deeply, deeply frustrating. Let me turn to Judicial Watch, your lawsuit against the Department of Education, trying to find out how in the world so much money is sloshing around from foreign nations and hostile powers at that. What are you hoping to find here, and why are we just now learning about all of this? We know the Chinese have been carrying out espionage activities and surveillance for the People's Republic of China for at least two decades in this country. Why now?
Well, you know, it's come to a head. And frankly, the Trump administration deserves credit for highlighting this issue, for all the complaints we've had about DOJ and FBI and state. You know, at least they're calling attention to the China problem in a coordinated way now. Department of Education, they're supposed to get reports from colleges and universities if those universities get $250,000 or more from a foreign government. According to one report, at least 70 colleges didn't report that type of grant activity from the Chinese. We want the details. We're suing for the info. We also have a lawsuit to the Qatarans. Qatar has given Texas A&M a boatload of money. We're in court against their high-priced lawyers to try to get information about that gift. Texas A&M has got a campus over it in Qatar, and they won't give us any details about the gift that seemingly has resulted in that campus being sent to that terror-supporting country.
Well, I, you know, obviously, I'm more concerned about China. I am more concerned about Russia. And when I'm asking what has taken so long, two decades of surveillance, I mean, this has been going on for 20 years, and only now are those agencies that have harassed and pursued and persecuted this president for 4 years, they're just now awakening to the fact that China is shipping in spies who don't tell the truth. I mean, I can't believe the nonsense that I'm hearing from the FBI, that they just can't believe that effectively that these Chinese nationals who were sent to this country by the PLA to spy and to steal U.S. technology and intellectual property, that they would lie on immigration documents? Are you kidding me?
Yeah, I'm old enough to remember, Lou, back in the Clinton administration where you had the Chinese in a coordinated effort trying to influence our elections, and we presume that just stopped. They were bankrolling Bill and Hillary Clinton, targeting Senator Feinstein. She got a briefing about it, but then presumably they stopped. Of course they didn't stop. They were let off the hook, And now we see the results 20 years later.
Absolutely. And thanks to you and to Judicial Watch, we see a little clearer. Thank you so much, Tom. Appreciate it.